From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. It is the largest democracy in the world, over 1 billion strong. And right now, it's at the height of a political fever pitch. In a massive exercise of democracy, India is taking over 600 million voters to the polls for national parliamentary elections. Now, if you've thought about India lately, you've probably thought about outsourcing and jobs. The South Asian tiger has a burgeoning economy, an enormous population base, and the lure of cheap labor. But economics are only the beginning. India is rising. The United States is watching. And many are wondering, what will the future of the U.S.-India relationship be? What should it be? Tonight on Point, India, American competitor or American ally? We begin in New Delhi, where the first round of India's three-week-long parliamentary elections began on Tuesday. Sheetal Rajput is principal correspondent for Zee News of India. I asked her, with as many as 670 million voters, how is the Indian government managing this election?
This is the first time, the first ever parliamentary elections in India, all over the country, when electronic voting machines were used for polling. And 20th of April was the first phase of polling, since it's such a big country, as you said, and such a big population. So elections are being held in four phases. The first phase was on the 20th of April. We have the next phase on 26th of April. Then third on 5th of May, and fourth phase on 10th of May. And then 13th is counting, and 15th of May, hopefully the new government would be formed. So like I told you, this was the first ever parliamentary elections in India where all over the country electronic voting machines were used. There was some information, some kind of reports of people not actually knowing how to use electronic voting machines. But those incidents were very few because information was imparted to people well in advance how to use EVMs. It's called the dance of democracy in the country because it's such a big exercise, you know, with such a large population.
Has there been any violence or any other problems?
There were 11 reported deaths in poll-related violence. But apart from that, it was generally peaceful. Elections were also held for two parliamentary seats in the state of Jammu and Kashmir, Baramula in Kashmir and Jammu in the Jammu province. Voting percentage, voter turnout in Jammu and Kashmir was lower than in the rest of the country. It was about 35% to 40%, but in the rest of the country, it was about average poll percentage was between 55% and 60%. And like I told you, violence, poll-related violence, took about 11 lives. But apart from that, all of the country, it was generally peaceful.
And are the votes counted as the polling continues, or do they wait to count up all the votes on May 13th?
Voting would be completed by 10th of May, and counting in general for all those seats takes place on 13th of May, yes.
So there's no influence in the first round. The results are not announced, so that might potentially influence the next three rounds.
No. But we've had our own exit polls. All media organizations and all TV channels and newspapers have been carrying their own exit polls after the first round because in totality there are 543 seats in the lower house for which elections would be held. And in the first round, polls were held for 140 seats. So it would be too early to predict anything. But most of the exit polls, they show a tilt towards NDA, the BJP-led NDA, the coalition government that has been ruling the country for the last 5 years.
I was going to say, you may not be able to give us specifics at this point, but what do you see as the likelihood that the BJP, the party in power, will be able to remain in power?
Like I said, it's too early to say, but the initial exit polls have been showing that there's a slight tilt towards BJP-led NDA, and it might end up forming the government again, maybe on the 15th of May or whenever. But, it seems a little different because a little difficult because the chief opposition party, which is the Congress, has also conjured up alliances, has also allied itself with the so-called some of the secular parties, as Congress calls itself the most secular party in the country. It's the chief opposition party. So it might become a little difficult in the end. But the initial exit polls and the initial reports, they do show a tilt towards the BJP-led NDA.
And are there any big issues in this campaign?
Issues. BJP has been saying, the India government has been saying that, you know, in their past 5 years, India has progressed by leaps and bounds, and it has become a power, and economically the GDP and all has risen, and we have really done well. And they have been leading the campaign with slogans like India Shining, and the so-called feel-good factor, they say, is going to work in their favor in these elections. While on the other hand, the chief opposition party, which is the Congress, and which is led by Sonia Gandhi, she belongs to the famous Gandhi family, as you must be knowing, the daughter-in-law of Indira Gandhi. She and her party members and other opposition parties have been saying that there is no such feel-good factor when you know. And for them, the main issue for these elections is underdevelopment, and they say that there's no development, there's so much of poverty, unemployment, and issues like that. But BJP has been talking about the rise, the economic rise that India has shown, and the feel-good factor is a main plank of theirs.
What is the Indian government's view overall of India's current relationship with the United States? There are several factors, obviously. One is U.S. support of Pakistan. One is concerns here about outsourcing of American jobs to India. And another, of course, is the war on terror.
The current government, the Bush administration, has been friendly towards Indian government. That's what people here, diplomatic experts and people feel. I mean, it's been, they say that it's been better than previous years, say the early years of the Bill Clinton regime. And they say that surely, for sure, in the past couple of years, the relationship between India and America has improved. But there are concerns regarding this issue of outsourcing, and Indians out here feel that the hue and cry that's being raised over the issue of outsourcing shouldn't be there, and there shouldn't be any legislations that the Democrats have been talking about. So there are concerns over the issue of outsourcing, and of course on certain other issues like terrorism and infiltration in PAC-sponsored terrorism. They want America to be a little more hard on terrorism, and particularly be more, what you call, harsh with Pakistan in telling them that, you know, they should stop sponsoring terrorism from across the border. But the general opinion is that in the past couple of years, in the Bush regime, relations between the two countries have definitely improved.
Thank you so much, Sheetal.
Thank you.
Sheetal Rajput is principal correspondent for Zee News. She spoke with us from New Delhi, India. We're talking this hour about the political, economic, and strategic relationship between the United States and India. How should the U.S. be reacting to India's growing economy? Are you worried about losing your job to businesses in Bangalore? Should Washington look at New Delhi as a political partner or economic adversary? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Bloomington, Illinois, is Sumeet Ganguly. He is professor of political science, Indian culture and civilization at Indiana University in Bloomington. Hello and welcome, Sumeet.
Good evening.
Let me ask you, first of all, if you can kind of bring us up to date and give us a quick sketch of just how the relationship between the U.S. and India has changed over the past 50 years or so.
Indo-U.S. relations has changed really quite dramatically, and not so much over the past 50 years, because during much of the Cold War, India and the United States found themselves at odds. While they were not really, the relationship was not really adversarial, it was nevertheless a prickly relationship, and often characterized by periods of American engagement and disengagement with India. And occasionally, there was even an undertone of hostility to the relationship. It's really in the last decade that one has seen a fundamental transformation of the relationship, because with the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union, the principal irritant in Indo-U.S. relations, namely India's fairly close ties to the Soviet Union, disappeared. And also, the model of economic development that India had pursued, which essentially cut its economy off from much of the world, also came to an end with the end of the Cold War, and thereby it was possible to have a more meaningful and robust economic relationship with the United States. So with the geostrategic changes and with changes in the global economy and a fundamental shift in India's strategy of economic development, one saw a blossoming of Indo-U.S. relations over the course of the last decade. Even just 2 weeks ago, Indian and American forces were engaged in a military exercise on the extreme eastern borders of India in the Indian Jungle Warfare School. The Indians have lots of experience with counterinsurgency, and that's why the United States, it's one area where the U.S. military is cooperating. Major American firms have now invested in India. Firms like General Electric, firms like Ford, firms like IBM have a significant presence now in India. So the relationship has both an economic and strategic ballast to it.
Hmm. And the assumption in the U.S. often is that we're the teachers, the rest of the world are the students. You mentioned counterinsurgency. What else might the U.S. learn from India?
The U.S. Has a number of areas where the U.S. could benefit from India. Indian software, as we well know, is increasingly making inroads into the global market. The software industry in India is a multi-billion dollar industry. Three Indian firms this year have crossed the billion dollar mark. Now, that may not be an enormous amount when you think of a company like Microsoft, which the annual turnover is something in the neighborhood of $15 billion. But the point is that there is interesting innovation taking place in India in the software industry. So this is one area which is an area where the United States could benefit from working with India.
Do you feel that the U.S. can count on India as a partner, or should it be viewed more as a competitor?
I certainly do not think that India is anywhere near being a competitor of the United States. All one has to do is look at the gross domestic products of the two countries, and you would see the disparity. India is still very much a fledgling, developing economy. There are certain oases of excellence, software being one of them, pharmaceuticals being another, there are certain sectors of the Indian economy which are doing exceedingly well. But one has to recognize that even by India's official statistics, close to 25% of the population still remains below the Indian poverty line, and that's poverty defined at something like $2 a day per person. So India is anything but a competitor and will not be a competitor for a very long period of time as far as the United States is concerned.
So is it your sense then that it's a real stretch, despite its population and its potential, to think of India as being a superpower one day? Is that way, way, way down the road?
It's at least a good 20 to 30 years down the road. And even if India emerges as a superpower, there's no necessary set of conflicts of interest with the United States. The areas where the United States and India would compete would be areas of economics. And while one occasionally has had a difficult relationship, say, for example, with Japan, one doesn't think about the United States and Japan in the post-war era of actually going to war because of a trade deficit. And yes, there have been acrimonious moments when people in Detroit were losing their jobs. But these are things that are subject to negotiation. So even when India emerges, say, 20 years down the road or 30 years down the road as a major economic force, one could still find ways of negotiating these differences. And in terms of strategic interests, India is so far away from the United States, and India's concerns are so different from those of the United States, I do not see India emerging as a strategic competitor of the United States.
All right. Much more to be said on this topic. We're going to take a break and then we'll return to it. We're talking this hour about India, whether it is a U.S. competitor or ally. Is the United States responding appropriately to the economic challenges from India? How important, how critical is the U.S.-India relationship to India and to the U.S.? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to hear from you. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the South Asian tiger, India, as American competitor or ally. Is America responding appropriately to economic challenges from India? And in the era of the war on terror, how important is it for the U.S. to keep India as a close ally? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Earlier this month, On Point spoke with former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and when asked to describe what he thinks are the most important crises the United States faces today, Kissinger had some surprising things to say.
Well, we have an immediate crisis in Iraq. We have a longer-term challenge of the emergence of countries, immediately China, in a little while India, into the international system. So all of these things are challenges that foreign policy has to deal with.
That was Henry Kissinger from an On Point interview earlier this month. And we're continuing our discussion now with Sumeet Ganguly, professor of political science, Indian culture and civilization at Indiana University in Bloomington. And also joining us from Santa Cruz, California, is Nirvikar Singh, professor of economics at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Welcome to you, Nirvikar.
Thank you.
So did Kissinger get it right in your view? Do you see India as a real challenge?
I think actually Sumeet Ganguly stated it more clearly than Kissinger did. There's a clear difference between strategic competition and the emergence of India and China perhaps as strategic powers. Well, China is already a strategic power, and that is very distinct from India and China's increased economic role. And I think it's important to understand that economic competition is not a zero-sum game. I think ultimately the economic development of India and China and Asia in general will be beneficial to the United States and the rest of the world.
We were speaking a moment ago from the perspective of the United States and how it views India as ally or competitor, and I wonder if the same question were to be posed from the Indian perspective, the U.S. as ally or competitor, what might the answer be? Would it be the same?
Well, I think from the Indian perspective, the United States is, first of all, the most important market for India, and secondly, it's a very important source of training and ideas. I think the success of India's software industry has relied on both access to U.S. markets and access to U.S. Knowledge.
And Sumeet, let's talk for a moment about how India asserts itself. Obviously, there are going to be differences of opinion, even among allies. India has been willing to stand up to the U.S., for example, in the matter of its willingness or not to send troops to Iraq, despite several requests, without a specific mandate from the U.N. I mean, how do you see that in the context of the larger relationship?
Well, I think as long as these things are not sort of stated in neuralgic terms, there is no reason why allies can't agree to disagree. The sad part is during much of the Cold War, the Indian rhetoric about the United States was stated in rather harsh and rather prickly language, which often irritated and piqued American decision makers and thereby simply contributed to a widening chasm in the relationship between India and the United States. On this occasion, when India refused to send troops to Iraq, it was done in a fashion that was not insulting. The language was not invidious in any fashion. The Prime Minister simply said that, look, we have our own national security concerns, and we have a limited number of forces, and it's simply not possible to spare any forces for Iraq. Now, obviously, he was being somewhat economical with the truth. India could have easily sent a contingent from a million-man army to Iraq. I think there were other factors involved. With an election coming up, he could ill afford to lose substantial numbers of Indian troops in Iraq, as we are now witnessing. India has had lots of experience with counterinsurgencies, and Indian decision-makers probably feared that there could be significant costs. In addition to that, sending a contingent of Indian troops would have alienated some of the Arab states from India, and India has a very substantial Muslim population, and this particular government has not had the best relationship with the Muslim population of India, and that's putting it rather mildly. So all these factors probably went into that mix. But the manner in which it was stated to the United States was not, was not grating or unpleasant. And as long as Indian diplomacy can indeed be dexterous and can engage in a bit of fancy footwork, I think differences can be contained.
Do you think then if the BJP remains in power after the parliamentary elections and if the U.S. keeps pushing, as we might expect it would, that position on the troops might change?
Only if there is a U.N. mandate. Then India might consider sending a token contingent of highly trained troops who have been engaged in peacekeeping operations elsewhere. And the Indian army is fairly stoic. It takes casualties fairly well. But with the imprimatur of the UN, it would be much more politically palatable in India. And also with the elections behind this government, they would be much more prone to taking a risk.
All right, let's go to the phone lines now. Find out what some of our listeners have to say. First to Erie, Pennsylvania. Greg is on the line. Hi, Greg. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Good. My question is more of an economic one. Some years back, people in the United States were concerned about Japan as a competitor because initially it was a low-wage country. But over time, Japanese wages rose, and essentially they become more on parity with the United States. But their population is only about 50 million. And basically, it was sort of said that we absorbed that economy. But I think the concern a lot of Americans have is that you'll never absorb the low-wage job structure of a place like India or China because you have so many millions and millions of people, and that this is going to basically permanently pressure to depress wages in the United States and other industrialized countries, and it will for a long, long time because of the size of the labor pool. Hmm. Would you comment on that, please?
Interesting point, Greg. Thanks. And, yes, let's put that to Nirvikar.
Okay. Let's see. I think the fear of depressing U.S. wages is probably overstated because if you look, at least in the Indian case, if you look at the skill composition of the Indian labor force, I think you'll see that there's actually very limited competition. Secondly, what determines the payment to workers is not just their skills, but also all the infrastructure that they're working with. So for example, if a U.S. company is thinking of locating in India, certainly the wage difference matters a lot. But the things that affect productivity are the kind of infrastructure available in India and so on. And often those things will tip the scales in the opposite direction, where the U.S. company won't shift jobs. So I think if you look at how much manufacturing has actually shifted to Asia to these very low-wage jobs, I'm just shifting now to thinking about China, and you'll see if you look at the impact on real wages in the United States, I think it's been relatively small. There is definitely a debate about the impact of trade and technological change going hand in hand on real wages in the United States. And we do know that real wage growth in the United States has been relatively anemic. But I think it's if you try to say separate out what has been the impact of India and China, I think it's been relatively small. And I think in the future also it will be relatively small. Now, certain kinds of jobs I think will move to developing countries because it is much cheaper to do them there. But I don't think that leads to an overall depression of the U.S. wage level.
Well, Nirvikar, to that point, we have Lakshmi on the line from Newton, Massachusetts. Lakshmi, what was your thought about that?
Well, I'll sort of continue on in the same vein. I was listening in earlier, and the partnership between the two countries was described as potentially having a innovative factor as well as, a strategic alliance on the political side. But, the conversation these days in the USA about the outsourcing of jobs has to do less with the innovative aspect, but more with the routine, outsourcing of routine work, the back office jobs, the tax preparation, the medical transcriptions, things of that nature. And really it's, in a sense, it's sort of equivalent to immigrant workers coming into this country to do those sorts of low-end jobs in the agricultural side, say, strawberry picking. And so my question really is, at least in the short run, who really benefits? Is it the average American and the average Indian, or is it the corporations? Because from what I'm reading, it's just 250. I don't know the scale of this outsourcing, but it's not. It's less than 500,000 jobs, which is a lot when you look at it from the U.S. Point of view, but not too much when you look at the people nation like India.
Thanks, Lakshmi. Well, I think we got the question. Let's put it to Nirvikar.
Okay, so I think from the Indian side, I think it's true that a relatively small segment of the population is directly benefiting from the jobs that are coming up in India. But I don't think that's a bad thing, and it's something that will have positive spillovers. Just as the success of Indian software engineers has spilled over into more routine kinds of jobs, back office jobs. I mean, basically, India has become it's more acceptable as a place to invest. And obviously, that's it's a long way from that to making a difference to the average Indian. But certainly, I think it's all in the right direction. Now, from the American side, clearly there are losers when certain industries find jobs moving overseas, whether it's manufacturing. I think textiles is one good example, or now these service jobs. Certainly, there are losers, but I think American consumers are actually very big winners, and so it's hard to talk about the average American. There are differences in the winners and losers. The winners are very a broad-based group, and the losers tend to be concentrated in the industries that are being affected. But I think the way to see what's going on is if you think about, say, the U.S. 100 years ago. The U.S. probably had an employment structure that looked like what India's is now, with the majority of people working in agriculture. All those jobs have disappeared. The U.S. has lost a lot of agricultural jobs, even if you count the migrant workers. And yet the U.S. is much richer, a much richer economy than it ever was 100 years ago. So in the long run, these adjustments work out. I think the correct thing to focus on is what is the appropriate policy response to reduce the short run pain for those who are losers in the short run.
And I want to put that also to Sumit. How do you see that playing out? Will there be short term pain but long term benefit?
Oh, there's no question about it. I agree with Nirvikar's analysis, and particularly his last point that in the 19th century, the U.S. was a predominantly agricultural economy. Those jobs have gone. They're not coming back anytime soon. But as an economy matures, certain jobs do disappear. Obviously, one must find ways of mitigating the pain of those individuals who are losing their jobs, because of a consequence of foreign competition, or because the job has been transported elsewhere. But I might add something to the original question, a component of an answer to the original question, namely that the U.S. economy every quarter creates about 30 million jobs. And approximately about that many jobs are also lost in the American economy. And it's slightly more than 30 million jobs are created every quarter. Over the course of the last 5 years, only about 200,000 jobs have fled to India. So when we're talking about outsourcing, we're really talking about a political issue, not really an economic issue. The current economic doldrums in the United States is a function of much more complex features of the American economy, and it has to do with certain kinds of fiscal and monetary policies. It has very little to do with outsourcing, without denying for one moment the very real pain of the software engineer who has lost his job, or the computer technician who has lost his job, or the individual who relied on working for a call center which has moved to Bangalore or Hyderabad.
Sumit, I want to just get a closing thought on this topic from Dilip, who's on the line from Madison, Wisconsin. Hello, Dilip, and welcome to you.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call. I just want to make a brief comment to the previous conversations which you were having. U.S. is only 4.5% share of world population, but it consumes 30% of private consumption throughout the world. In contrast, South Asia, with 22.4% of the world's population, had just 2% share of the world's private consumption. The reason why I called, however, is that your premise of the show should be your title should be different, that we are not competitors, we are allies, because we are the world's two largest democracy. So instead of America getting into bed with every tin horn dictators it can find for its own gain, it should learn to help the third world countries, the fledgling countries who are democracy, and boost and work with them as opposed to consider them as competitors.
Thank you so much for the call, Dilip. And I would imagine Sumit and Nirvikar would agree with you as well. Thanks so much, Sumit, for joining us.
My pleasure.
He is professor of political science, Indian culture and civilization at Indiana University. And Nirvikar Singh, thank you for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure, too.
He is professor of economics at the University of California, Santa Cruz. You can continue the conversation at our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. After the break, we'll be talking about photos of the fallen and the controversy surrounding the publication of pictures of flag-draped coffins coming home from Iraq. Should those pictures be public, or are there reasons for keeping the images hidden? How did you feel when you saw them? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. The Pentagon was busy today defending its ban on the publication of images of soldiers' coffins as American casualties continue to come home from Iraq. The ban was instituted in 2000, but was in the news again last Sunday when the Seattle Times published a photo of flag-draped coffins being loaded onto a transport plane bound for the U.S. The photographer and her husband, both military contractors in Kuwait, were subsequently fired for having violated Department of Defense and company policies. The story intensified yesterday when a website called The Memory Hole published dozens of photographs of coffins returning to the Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. The Pentagon has since said that releasing those photos was a mistake. But that hasn't stopped several news organizations from publishing pictures from the website. And you can see those photos on our website, onpointradio.org. And so we put the question to you. How did seeing those photographs make you feel? Should images like these be public? Or are there good reasons for keeping them under wraps? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us now from New York is William Sarin, Associate Professor of Journalism at New York University and also co-editor of Muckraking, The Journalism That Changed America. Hi, William.
How are you?
Very well, thanks. Appreciate your being here. And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Gail. Hello, Mr. Sarin.
Hi.
William, I want to turn to you first, because obviously not many people are going to quarrel with the assertion that pictures are powerful. They have a resonance that words can't always match, which perhaps explains the Pentagon's no pictures policy. But how has the government's position about pictures changed over time, not just since 2000?
Well, you know, where I live in New York City, we're about six, seven blocks from where Matthew Brady's studio was in September of 1862. And that was where he had, in his gallery, he put up an exhibition of photographs of the Antietam battlefield. And it was the first time that that war was brought home, to first to New Yorkers and then to America. And I must tell you, I in this tragic situation, in this war, I rejoice these pictures are published, because for the first time, it brings home to America what's going on.
Jack, were those pictures a jolt to you?
Yes, they always are. But, you know, we had Susan Sontag on the program a few weeks ago. She was talking about her book on war photography called On Viewing the Pain of Others. And she made the point that it's not enough to be shocked. It's not enough to feel compassion. That when we see photographs like this, we have to ask why. We have to make it an occasion for reflection. Why did these people die? And, you know, we know the ideal answer for democracy in Iraq. Let's hope that comes. But it happens that Marketplace, the public radio program, has been running a series called The Spoils of War, about corruption and profiteering in Iraq. They point out that $4 billion of the $22 billion we're spending there on reconstruction has gone off in corruption. Tens of millions of dollars are being ripped off by the members of the governing council. American contractors are getting in on it, translators, bribes up and down the line. And this could have been stopped by sending congressional auditors out there, but the White House prevented that. And now the Pentagon is hiring private auditors to look into it. Of course, the private auditors themselves can be bribed. So here's this sort of circus of bribery and corruption, and here are these young men who died. And you just have to put the two things together, and that, to me, is what's shocking.
And, of course, the irony is that the woman who took the first pictures that were published had herself lost a child, not in the war, but and her purpose in doing this was to show the families that these soldiers were being treated with great respect.
Yeah, you know, in 1969, Life magazine published a wonderful thing. In that one issue, the pictures of everyone who died that week in Vietnam. And David Halberstam later said that that helped change the war. And, you know, I teach at NYU. I teach a class in muckraking. And I email my students today. I said, look this stuff up today, because these are not journalists. But this is an example of muckraking. And I think our country is better today than it was yesterday because this stuff was published.
Well, let's hear what some of our listeners have to say on this topic. Dan's on the line from Viola, Wisconsin. Hello, Dan.
Hello. My comment is simply that I have read the inner workings of the reasoning on the Bush administration for imposing this ban, was that polls have indicated, and I don't know exactly how the data was obtained, that one of the biggest factors sinking the Democratic Party in the 68 election was the images of the soldiers' bodies coming home from Vietnam. And President Bush doesn't want the same effect on his own reelection, and I think that is the only real reason behind this ban.
All right, Dan, appreciate the phone call. And, William, there's also, as I'm sure you know, endless discussions in newsrooms about what pictures are appropriate to publish. So we're not just talking about censorship from the government. There's also the question of self-censorship from various media outlets.
You know, it's funny because I'm just looking, and I guess someone today published, CBS today ran pictures of Princess Diana, before she died, which I think is reprehensible. But these are pictures, but the war pictures have to run. They really do. You know, in World War II, we did not publish, we being the media, we did not publish pictures of dead Americans in 1943. And that's when FDR thought that patriotism was wavering. And that's when the first pictures of dead Americans were published in World War II. I think the truth is good for all of us. I really do. The truth is good for all of us.
Do you find it significant, Jack, that Fox Network chose not to show those flag-draped coffins?
Not at all. As we know from studies, people who watch that network were, I don't know, 5 or I think actually 40 times as liable as listeners of public radio to have profound misconceptions, in fact, to accept lies about the Iraq War. So fair and balanced, no, I'm not surprised.
1-800-423-8255 is our number if you'd like to weigh in on this. From Reading, Massachusetts, Ron's on the line. Hello, Ron.
Oh, hi. I'm a physician, and I don't understand all that much about politics. To tell you the truth, when one speaks for the war, it sounds pretty logical. And then another one speaks against it, it sounds logical, too. They're so clever. But I know what's in those boxes. I'm a doctor. And for me, they died for nothing. Dead is dead. Beautiful children, it's an awful thing, and I think the people should see those pictures, and I'm glad somebody publishes them.
And you think they should see them? Why?
Because it's the truth. That's what it boils down to. It boils down to young children coming home in boxes for nothing. Nothing. Look at Vietnam. They say, oh, no, this isn't Vietnam. Well, what's the difference for the kids? It's exactly the same thing, and I'm glad to see it, and I'm proud to read the paper today and see that.
Ron, thank you for the call. To Madison, Wisconsin, Lucy's on the line. Hello, Lucy. What's your thought?
I feel as though as long as they're not showing people's faces and they're simply showing a coffin that's flag-draped, that's an honorable way to represent sacrifice that somebody's made. And by seeing those coffins come back in this honorable fashion, I think it also makes people more aware of the true consequences of war and perhaps will make better decisions based with the full knowledge of what those consequences are.
You know, also, if I may say so, I think I'm right. I don't think there's been a picture of a dead American, except for perhaps when early on in the war when that transportation unit was ambushed. I don't think it's astonishing. This has been, what, a year and a half now? And there's not a picture of a dead American in a major American newspaper or on television.
Hmm.
Nor has there been.
Why is that?
Yeah, and there really hasn't even been any verbal descriptions.
Exactly.
I don't, you know, I've read John Burns by the Yard, admirable reporter.
Exactly.
And I've read him talking about dead Iraqis. I have not seen a description of a dead American soldier.
Yeah, right.
And so how that played out over time, William, you know, as you say, in World War II, was the thought except for that time when FDR thought that our patriotism needed to be flagged? What, it was simply too horrifying for people to see?
Yeah, you know, I'm a sort of, I wake up in the middle of the night a lot, and I watch the History Channel. And I've seen stuff I've never seen before, like hosing down hundreds of dead bodies in the South Pacific in World War II, which has never, ever been published in books or printed, you know, on television. And I think it's a scandal. I really do. I think the American press should I have no idea why we don't publish these pictures. It just annoys me so much. When I came home today and I saw those pictures, I was, you know, in a very sad, macabre way, I was pleased to see the pictures. I really was.
1-800-423-8255 is our number. To Gillette, Wyoming now. Marge is on the line. Hello, Marge.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Our local newspaper, the Gillette News Record, recently published a photograph of one of our young Wyoming soldiers who had some face trauma from shrapnel, and he had a reconstructive plastic surgery. And they showed his face after the reconstruction. And, you know, obviously he was scarred. The outcry from the local people was horrendous. They were shocked that they would show,
really,
quote-unquote, such horrible pictures. Now, I just think it's a disgrace not to show these pictures. This is this man's reality now. And for us to pretend that war and disfigurement and death don't exist together is a real misconception. We can't make this look nice. It's an ugly, ugly thing. And I agree with most of your other commentators that this we need to show such pictures.
Marge, did your local newspaper publish the pictures of the coffins draped in flags?
You know, I'm on the road on a business trip, and I don't know if they have now. But I would expect after the outpour of negative press from this other picture, they probably did not.
All right, Marge, thank you so much. To Milwaukee, Wisconsin now, and Tim is on the line. Hello, Tim.
How are you, ma'am?
Very well, thanks.
I wanted to call in and give just a little bit of a different perspective on what you're talking about. I'm a retired senior military officer. The military is like a very, very close-knit family. And if you could imagine a funeral of your family members with people that you don't know with cameras and microphones trying to intrude upon it, I think you might have a sense of one of the reasons why some of the military people don't want to see the potential for disrespect or intrusion of privacy for young men or women that have been, their lives have been taken in a situation like that. Now, I know there's all kinds of other reasons, and I'm no politician, but I can tell you from the perspective of people that look after young men and women in the military, there is that dimension. We just don't want their privacy intruded upon.
Well, Tim, we appreciate your sharing your perspective with us. And, Jack, I put it to you. There are those who say if you show those pictures, you erode America's will to fight by making the emotional price too high. So it leads to the question of, if we saw the true pictures of combat, would America ever go to war?
I don't believe it would. I don't believe that if people read a book called With the Old Breed on Okinawa, a 700-page memoir of what that was like. I think reading that one book alone would essentially, for everybody, would rule war out except in the direst necessity. You can't read it and say this can happen to human beings. And, you know, there is a contradiction between democracy and war. Leaders have worried about it for years because people in democracies can change their governments. They don't want war. And the government always has to be cognizant of that. And in the Second World War, many people thought that would be a weakness in fighting the totalitarian states that didn't have to worry about that. But it's also a strength, of course, because it limits foreign adventurism, or it should.
And we also saw today the death of Pat Tillman, or learned of it today.
A very tragic story, but you know what's going to happen in that? That story is going to be played very big tomorrow and over the weekend. And in a way, it's kind of sad because what have we lost, 700 Americans? And watch where this story is being played. And the guy was a great young man, terrific. All I'm saying is watch how that story is played.
William Saron, we'll have to leave it there for now. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, as always, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
For more on this story and to view some of the images we've been talking about, you can go to our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.